I commend the exceptional bravery of Officer Eric Talley. I send my deepest condolences to his family, his close, close family and 7 children. Every time an officer walks out of his or her home and pins that badge on, the family member that they just said goodbye to wonders whether they'll subconsciously, will they get that call, the call that his wife got. He thought he'd be coming home to his family and his 7 children. But when the moment to act came, Officer Tully did not hesitate in his duty, making the ultimate sacrifice in his effort to save lives. That's a definition of an American hero.
President Biden speaking yesterday about police officer Eric Talley, who was killed in Monday's mass shooting at a grocery store in Boulder, Colorado. Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Wednesday, March 24th. With us, we have White House reporter for the Associated Press, Jonathan Lemire, former chairman of the Republican National Committee, now an MSNBC political analyst, Michael Steele, and professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, MSNBC contributor, Victoria DeFrancesco Soto. We are learning new details this morning about the mass shooting that took place inside a Boulder, Colorado grocery store. The suspected gunman has been charged with 10 counts of murder. So far, investigators have not commented on a possible motive, though law enforcement sources say at this point there is no evidence to suggest the shooting was an act of terror or a hate crime. Several law enforcement sources also say he may have had a history of mental health issues. Records show this wasn't the suspect's first brush with the law. In 2017, he was charged with misdemeanor assault after attacking a high school classmate who said had called him racial names. An arrest affidavit shows the suspect purchased an assault weapon on March 16th, just 6 days before the attack at the supermarket. A makeshift memorial is taking shape outside the grocery store where the attack happened. The 10 victims range in age from 20 to 65 years old. They included 3 grocery store workers, several people who just happened to be shopping that afternoon, and a police officer who rushed to the scene. The Boulder police chief remembered the slain officer, Eric Talley, yesterday for his unwavering dedication to his job, family, and community.
This officer had 7 children. Ages 5 to 18. I just had that officer's whole family in my office 2 weeks ago to give him an award. I tell you that he's a very kind man, and he didn't have to go into policing. He had a profession before this, but he felt a higher calling. And he loved this community, and he's everything that policing deserves and needs. He was willing to die to protect others.
Joining us now live from Boulder, NBC News correspondent Katie Beck. Katie, what more can you tell us about the investigation so far?
Good morning, Mika. Yeah, what we can tell you is that this investigation is going around the clock, focusing in on the one thing everyone is talking about, the one thing everyone wants to know. What was the motive? What was the reason that this happened? That answer still remains at this hour unknown. We have not heard from police on what they have gathered in the past 12 hours or so. We're hoping to get more on that today. What we do know is that suspected gunman, they have been searching his car, searching his home, and searching his social media accounts to try and glean any information about what he may have been thinking in the days leading up to that shooting. We do know that, as you mentioned, he had purchased a high-powered firearm just a week beforehand, and we know that at 2:30 on Monday, he entered that grocery store indiscriminately firing on innocent people, witnesses calling police, telling them horrifying accounts of being inside, trying to protect themselves and others from the gunfire. In an exchange with police, that suspect was wounded and surrendered into custody, now charged with 10 counts of first-degree murder. But as that investigation persists and a motive is sought, the ground here in Boulder is filled with grieving community members. Another Colorado community absolutely changed forever as they remember these victims. These were real people in their community. It's hard not to become sad when you hear about the soon-to-be grandfather who was inside. You hear about the clerk who had worked there for 30 years and known so many people that have come through the doors of that store. And then you hear about the 25-year-old who was just getting started in life. All of these people were in different phases of life and different chapters, but all of them had hopes and dreams and real families here that are grieving. Colorado has a long and disturbing history with mass shootings everywhere from Columbine to Aurora and now Boulder. This is something that Colorado has experienced before. I think moving the conversation forward now, how do we prevent the next one? Mika.
And NBC's Katie Beck, thank you very much for your report this morning. Here's more of what President Biden said yesterday from the White House.
Jill and I are devastated. And the feeling, I just can't imagine how the families are feeling, the victims whose futures were stolen from them, from their families, from their loved ones, who now have to struggle to go on and try to make sense of what's happened. While we're still waiting for more information regarding the shooter, his motive, the weapons he used, the guns, the magazines, the weapons, the modifications that apparently have taken place to those weapons that are involved here, I don't need to wait another minute, let alone an hour, to take common sense steps that will save the lives in the future and to urge my colleagues in the House and Senate to act. We can ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines in this country once again. I got that done when I was a senator. It passed. It was law for the longest time. And it brought down these mass killings. We should do it again. We can close the loopholes in our background check system, including the Charleston loophole. That's one of the best tools we have right now to prevent gun violence. The Senate should immediately pass. Let me say it again. The United States Senate, I hope some are listening, should immediately pass the two House passed bills that close loopholes in the background check system.
Well, the background check system loophole, those sort of bills have overwhelming popular support. When you talk about military-style weapons, those numbers go down a bit. It seems to me the easiest thing for them to pass, I say easy, no gun legislation getting passed is easy, but more expanded background checks, at least over the past several years, have been a 90-10 issue. Jonathan Lemire, so you you wrote an article for the AP, and you talked about how disciplined the Biden White House has been over the first 50, 60 days or so. How have these unplanned real-world events, first Atlanta, then the border crisis growing when Democrats started going there, taking pictures and reporting back, and then Boulder. How is that impacting the Biden White House right now, and how are they adjusting to those real-time changes?
Yeah, Joe, for so many White Houses, even the most carefully laid plans can be overwhelmed by real-world events, by sudden breaking news and crises. And that's what has happened here to this administration. The White House is just now only 10 days or so from signing into law that $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill. It's sort of a signature accomplishment, a big deal, no doubt. And they wanted to spend the next couple of weeks sort of really touting that before moving on to the next pieces of his agenda. And instead, two of his three first stops heading out on the road to talk about this bill have been drowned out by these mass shootings. Last week, he was heading to Atlanta. That day was completely repurposed because of the bias crimes that happened there against Asian Americans. And then yesterday, his trip to Ohio was completely overwhelmed by his having to address this tragedy in Boulder.
And Democrats, of course, have expressed some concerns about the border situation. We're going to have one of those Democrats on today. Also, Senator Murphy almost brought to tears by what he saw there. Jonathan, how are the Democrats holding together? Does the Biden White House feel like, whether it's on possible gun legislation or whether we're talking about an answer to the border crisis, or, of course, talking about what's probably next on their issue, infrastructure? How is that Democratic caucus holding together?
The Democrats pride themselves, Joe, on being such a big tent party, and there's a lot of competing interests there, different groups who want different things to be prioritized next. The Biden campaign in the general election and in its first 50, 60 days deserves credit for kind of keeping all those oars rowing in the same direction, unified around a common purpose. During the campaign, it was defeating Donald Trump. And here, during the first stretch of his presidency, it was about getting that COVID relief bill passed and signed into law. But now comes the hard part, where you're having different groups push different things, whether it be about gun control, whether it be about immigration, whether it be about voting rights acts. And the Biden administration, they want all of that to happen. They have said they will want all of that plus infrastructure and jobs. But it'll get harder now, particularly because it's likely going to require some sort of filibuster reform to make that happen. This is going to really test party unity these next few weeks.
And so here we go. There was a hearing yesterday in the Senate Judiciary Committee on how to address gun violence in America, scheduled before Monday's shooting in Boulder, in which Democrats and Republicans had very different takes on the issue.
America awoke today to another nightmare, stunning, shocking, savage, but unsurprising. Inaction has made this horror completely predictable. Inaction by this Congress makes us complicit.
These victims and their loved ones are worthy of our thoughts and our prayers. But there's more that's required. We face a pandemic of coronavirus. We have another epidemic in America called guns.
Senator from Connecticut just said, it's time for us to do something. I agree. It is time for us to do something. And every time there's a shooting, we play this ridiculous theater where this committee gets together and proposes a bunch of laws that would do nothing to stop these murders. What happens in this committee after every mass shooting is Democrats propose taking away guns from law-abiding citizens because that's their political objective. But what they propose, not only does it not reduce crime, it makes it worse.
What has happened in the last few days, what's happened in the last years, is, of course, tragic. And I'm not trying to perfectly equate these two, but we have a lot of drunk drivers in America that kill a lot of people. We ought to try to combat that, too. But I think what many folks on my side of the aisle are saying is that the answer is not to get rid of all sober drivers. The answer is to concentrate on the problem.
It is to concentrate on the problem. And, of course, over the past 20, 30 years, groups like Mothers Against Drunk Driving have done exactly that. And have changed, entirely changed the culture around drunk driving and have made a great difference, have saved so many lives, an untold number of lives. And yes, Michael Steele, that is exactly, I don't think he meant to do it, but Senator Kennedy actually pointed to what we need to do as a nation. We need to get serious about this. Does this mean taking away law-abiding citizens' guns? No. I mean, the Heller decision said we can't do that. And I know conservatives like you and me were glad when Heller came down and that actually the Second Amendment was determined to say exactly what the Second Amendment said, which is Americans have a right to keep and bear arms and protect themselves inside their house. That's what it said. But how any senator on the extreme right could take expanded background checks and somehow lie to their constituents, lie. Because if you look at the Second Amendment and you look at the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Second Amendment, they're lying if they say that expanded background checks is somehow infringing on anybody's Second Amendment right. It's just not.
No, you're absolutely right, Joe. And it has been a lie that's been promulgated, perpetuated, and just, you know, rolled out at moments like this for the last 20 years or so. And the reality is exactly in the space that you've described. The Supreme Court has given us the clarity that we need on the Second Amendment and what it means and what it doesn't mean with respect to individual liberties, and but also what government at the state level in states like Florida and Ohio and elsewhere, or at the federal level, can do to begin to address some of the growing concerns communities have around these issues. What you heard yesterday is what we've heard before. Thoughts and prayers, but we ain't doing crap. And the American people are tired of that. As you noted, this is a 70 to 80% issue with the American people. There aren't a whole lot of issues on that list. Just go through it. For Democrats, just, you know, move to that space where you can have the conversation. For Republicans, since you're so hot about, oh, they're going to take our guns, then put a proposal on the table that you think will address the issues, as Ted Cruz and others have noted. So we're going to do this dance. We've done it before. We're going to hear it before in Columbine, Aurora, you name it. After all of these horrific events, our legislators get in a room and they say exactly what they just said. You could have taken tape, Joe, from after Columbine. You can take a tape after Aurora, any of these events, and just play it. Just put it on a loop.
Right. Yeah.
It's true.
And by the way, you bring up the Columbine, Aurora, Boulder. I mean, Colorado has been through so much through the years with these mass shootings. But we showed a picture of Senator Blumenthal. He's the senator who represents Newtown. We showed a picture of Senator Durbin. He's the senator who represents the city of Chicago. There's so much killing from guns. And if people of good faith on both sides decide they want to work together, and I've seen absolutely no evidence of that, especially from people on the far right. But if people of good faith decide to work together, there's a way to get an expanded background check in place that makes sure that people who buy guns can actually handle those guns. Again, we do the same with cars. Thank you so much for bringing that up,
exactly.
Senator Kennedy.
As he thought he was deflecting.
We make sure that people actually know how to use the guns, have an expanded background check. I mean, I know gun shop owners, they don't want people buying guns that don't know how to use guns. Certainly, at least not the people that I've bought guns from before. They want to make sure you know the gun.
They don't want them in the wrong hands.
And they don't want them in the wrong hands. And that's the other thing. The overwhelming majority of crimes, maybe not this one, but the overwhelming majority of crimes, and law enforcement officers have told me this for years, those crimes are committed by people who didn't legally purchase the guns themselves. Perhaps it's not in this case, but it certainly is in the majority of crimes committed with guns. So we have to be, there are ways for people of good faith to come together and actually save lives. The same way, thank you, Senator Kennedy, that we did when Mothers Against Drunk Drivers and other people started to get aggressive about drunk driving. But we're not doing that with guns.
It's an epidemic, by the way.
And it is an epidemic.
It's every day.
It is an epidemic.
We're dealing with a pandemic. Can't we deal with an epidemic of gun violence?
And yeah, and unfortunately, as we see the good news of the pandemic starting to fade, we're now starting to see shootings coming back.
Because we didn't deal with the epidemic. Let's move now, and we'll revisit this, to the crisis on the southern border. The Biden administration still refuses to allow journalists inside the migrant facilities. Under pressure to provide more transparency, the federal government has now released its own video of the crowded conditions where migrants are being housed. NBC's Gabe Gutierrez has more on those images and a real-time look at migrants crossing the border.
The newly released images, shot last week by the government at border facilities in Donna and El Paso, Texas, depict crowded but orderly conditions. migrant children in mass having their temperatures taken, others exercising outside, small children on laps waiting to be processed, others sleeping on mats with Mylar blankets. A striking contrast, makeshift playpens in a place so far from home. The images were released a day after Democratic Texas Congressman Henry Cuellar leaked photos inside the Donna facility. Some rank-and-file Border Patrol agents who've been inside this facility say it's not their fault.
We're Border Patrol agents. We're not daycare. So that's not what we're designed for.
I'll go over to East and ask.
We rode along with the Texas Department of Public Safety, who helps federal agents patrol the border by air.
This is the epicenter of the migrant surge here in the Rio Grande Valley. The Texas DPS says that it's encountered nearly 9,000 migrants in just the last 2 weeks.
It took just a few minutes for us to start seeing migrant after migrant crossing.
Here comes another raft across. And here's another one.
That's 31 right here.
31 in that group alone?
Just in this group right here.
Some of them young children.
There's three children and the rest are adults.
And you guys are seeing this all day,
probably. All day long. You can see the coyotes returning to the Mexican side right now.
In just a few minutes that we've been up here, we've seen more than 60 migrants cross the border.
That's correct. And there's 12 there. Eight, 9 minutes time.
These troopers are also on the lookout for smugglers by boat. The battle at the border being fought on multiple fronts. Here along the Rio Grande, local and state authorities say they're having to fill the gaps as the Border Patrol diverts resources to handle the migrant surge.
Meanwhile, Mexico's president blames President Biden's policies for the surge in migrants. Yesterday, the Mexican president told reporters, quote, expectations were created that with the government of President Biden, there would be a better treatment of migrants. And this has caused Central American migrants and also from our country wanting to cross the border, thinking that it is easier to do so. The Biden administration has said it is developing a, quote, effective and humane plan to manage the migrant surge.
Well, and of course, the migrants should be treated humanely. But you can treat people humanely and still enforce
there are
laws.
A couple of questions here.
There are a couple of questions. Jonathan Lemire, I really want to get to Victoria in a second. But Jonathan, I'm just curious, what does the White House press corps think of the fact that the Biden administration is still blocking access to all reporters down there? It sounds like something that, well, I don't know. I'm very surprised.
What's going on?
That the only photos we have gotten out of here in the past, Jonathan, have come from Congressman Cuellar, and I believe we got one from the Connecticut Senator right. Murphy.
Right. Well, the White House press corps, of course, is always pushing for as much access and transparency as possible from the White House for any level of government. And certainly we have done so in this case, too. We've been asking the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki about this for quite some time. And the White House is saying that they are working on a plan to increase access. They say that is underway. They said they have to be careful of COVID protocols. They, of course, want to respect the privacy of the minors, the migrant children who are there. But they recognize that they need to be able to show the press corps and therefore the public what is going on. The Trump administration did, from time to time, allow media access to their facilities and at times revealed obviously terrible, heart-wrenching conditions. The Biden White House is saying, look, we're trying to improve the situation there. We will allow the press to get a look, but they haven't said when yet. They just keep saying soon, but they haven't pinned themselves down to an exact timetable. Obviously, the media is going to keep pressing for that to happen as soon as possible.
Victoria, obviously, the Biden administration is pushing back on saying there is a crisis at the border. Most Democratic legislators believe there is a crisis at the border. What can you tell us? What are you hearing and what are your thoughts?
Joe, I would claim that there's been a crisis at the border for close to two decades now. What we're seeing right now with the unaccompanied minors is a different type of crisis. I mean, take, for example, the beginning of the George W. Bush years, the early 2000s, we saw a huge surge of folks coming over, numbers that dwarf what we see today, but it was a different demographic. It was males coming over or adults coming over for economic purposes. What we're seeing now is a whole different ballgame. We're talking about families, we're talking about minors. So the crisis is not having that rapid policy response to adapt to this change in migratory flow. The migratory flow has been there for a long time because we haven't had a comprehensive immigration reform in a long time. And the challenge is, how do you deal with this very vulnerable population, this population that is coming over as a result of very intense push factors? Just recently, we saw the hurricanes in Central America batter Honduras, Guatemala, Nicaragua. These are folks whose crops, whose livelihoods were completely taken out, let alone their shelters. So when they are sitting there thinking, what do I have to lose in coming over and seeking asylum? We also need to understand those push factors. So in those policy levers, it's not just what do we do in the processes at the border, you know, on the north side of the border, but what do we do in the home countries that push these folks out?
We saw illegal immigration from Mexico go down when Mexico's economy actually strengthened. What sort of foreign aid do we need to provide these countries where we're getting most of these Central American migrants coming up?
Joe, if I had a magic wand, I would institute a Marshall Plan for Central America. We need economic aid, but targeted economic aid, just as it was in Europe after the war. It's not just throwing cash at a problem. It's working with these governments. It's working with the nonprofits and the other non-governmental institutions to stabilize. It also has to do with climate change. That's a long-term issue, but we know that in Guatemala in particular, the droughts of the last several years have pushed out the coffee farmers, the peasant farmers, and quite frankly, food insecurity is one of the big reasons. So if it were up to me, Joe, a Marshall Plan, and that's where we invest our money instead of throwing money at the border.
Much better. Okay. You know, there will be some people on the far right that don't want to provide that aid. And yet, you know, we can spend the money on the border. We can spend the money on enforcement. We can spend the money trying to track down illegal immigrants in the United States. Or we can spend the money actually at the source, helping these countries and taking away that sort of food insecurity. So we're investing our money, I think, more wisely and more humanely.
It's a return on investment, right? And I think this is something that the Republican Party has always been very quick to point out, right? What's the return on investment, both in business, but also in public policy? So it is in going down to the source of the problem, because immigration, whether it was from the 1700s, the 1800s, the 1900s, it's about push-pull factors. Why did we see the first large wave of Irish immigrants come over to the United States in the mid-1800s? Yep. It was because there was a potato famine and people could not feed themselves. They didn't want to come over just because they wanted a change of scenery. They came over because there was food insecurity. So why are we seeing folks from Central America leave? Same reason. And then layer on top of that, horrible gang violence, corrupt governments, problems that just compound themselves. So let's deal with the core issues that are pushing people out. It might take a little bit of time, but in the end, this is where the return on investment is going to be.
Victoria DeFrancisco Soto, thank you very, very much for being on this morning. We will see you again soon. And still ahead on Morning Joe, North Korea conducts its first weapons test since President Biden took office. David Ignatius joins us with his analysis. Plus, the European Union is considering tougher vaccine export rules, including blocking shipments to areas with higher vaccination rates like the UK. We'll talk about that escalating fight overseas. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
You know, Mika, I was just checking a Colorado paper on some of the stories, and they actually were quoting a Pew poll from 2019. Mm-hmm. 88% of Americans support background checks for private gun sales and sales at gun shows. 88% of Americans support that. That's what the House bill does.
Right.
But I guarantee you most Republicans oppose that. And you'd say, well,
how many issues
maybe
are they going to be on the wrong side?
Right. You say, well, maybe Republicans oppose that because their base opposes that, because most Republican voters oppose that. No,
they don't.
The same Pew poll showed 82% of Republicans support expanded background checks for private gun sales and for gun sales at gun shows.
Yeah.
Background checks. Listen, I own guns. Guns, plural. We got no problem with people doing all the background checks they want to do on me. It's no problem. And by the way, if my neighbor, if he or she get a gun, I want to know that they've had a background check too. And we have some background checks, but you know, law-abiding citizens can go through background checks and they can do the sort of things that I do. And if you've purchased guns that you can do, but what good does that do if somebody can walk into a gun show and purchase all the guns they want? I don't know if you all remember, but it was about a decade ago. We started talking about a terrorist, an Islamic terrorist that sent a message out to members, I believe it was, of Al-Qaeda, that said, and he was on the FBI's most wanted list. He said, hey, listen, if you really want to cause damage in America, just go to the gun shows, buy guns and use them there, because there are no safeguards. This insanity has been going on for so long. And again, I just want to underline this fact. 82% of Republicans support these type of expanded background checks. And it's been this way since Newtown. So when you see Republicans up there screaming and yelling, they're not screaming and yelling for their constituents. They're not screaming and yelling to support the people that I went to church with growing up, who would go hunting with their parents from, you know, an early age, when they were 6 or 7 or 8, and grew up with guns, knowing how to use guns safely. Right? Those people don't understand why people can go meet somebody in a parking lot and have them open up the back of a car and buy a gun legally without any background checks. It makes no sense to me. The numbers are on the side of the House bill.
Yeah.
When it comes to these expanded background checks for gun shows and private sales, I think most police officers want this to happen. If you want to support your officers in blue.
Yeah.
If blue lives matter to you, well, talk to your police chief. I guarantee you your police chief will support expanded background checks to make sure the good guys get the guns and the bad guys
don't. Joe, you mentioned Newtown. Senator Chris Murphy will be joining us a little later on the show to talk about just this and the point you just made here. For the first time since President Biden took office, North Korea has fired a missile. Two U.S. officials tell NBC News North Korea fired at least one missile over the weekend, but declined to specify what type was used. South Korea has yet to comment on the launch, and the White House seems to be trying to downplay the severity. One senior administration official called the launch normal military activities. Quote, North Korea has a familiar menu of provocations when it wants to send a message to U.S. administration, ballistic missiles of various range, mobile and submarine launch platforms, nuclear and thermonuclear tests. Experts rightly recognized what took place last weekend as falling on the low end of that spectrum. When asked, President Biden had this to say.
That to be a real provocation by North Korea?
No. According to the Defense Department, it's business as usual. There's no new wrinkle in what they did.
Let's bring in columnist and associate editor for The Washington Post, David Ignatius. David, of course, we all remember 4.5 years ago, Barack Obama tells Donald Trump, the incoming president, you can worry about Obamacare if you want, but it's going to be North Korea who keeps you awake at night. Then Donald Trump had a bizarre relationship with perhaps the most tyrannical communist dictator on the face of the earth, and sent love letters back and forth. And here we find ourselves 4 years later in the same position or in a worse position. I'm curious what your thoughts were about Joe Biden's response to the test.
Joe, this is a reminder that the North Korea problem is a real one. It is, as President Obama warned, something that is dangerous, carries the risk of war. I think it's right to say that this is at the low end of the things that North Korea could do. They haven't had a long-range missile test or a nuclear test since 2018. In a sense, they're coming off, North Korea's coming off the sugar high of intense personal diplomacy with Donald Trump. That was a most unusual relationship. Trump spoke about his messages to Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, as love letters. They were flattered by all the attention. In comes a new administration, and the Biden administration has not yet decided what approach it wants to take in diplomacy with North Korea. They're still working on it. They know they want to go back to diplomatic negotiations, but they're not sure how to set the table yet. Should they do this directly face-to-face with the North Koreans? Should they have a larger group of allies, so-called six-party talks? Those are the issues that they've been debating right up until these tests were announced. I think one important change from 4 years ago, President Trump, knowing that he had a serious standoff with North Korea, worked very hard in the beginning of his presidency to get China's Xi Jinping as an ally, in part to deal with the North Korea problem. And China was cooperative in those early months in trying to push Kim Jong-un to the table. The Biden administration has started off on a quite sharp and sour note with the Chinese. The meetings in Anchorage, Alaska, that Secretary Blinken and Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, had were not what you'd call friendly. Certainly, they don't set the table for joint action against North Korea. So we'll see. I think there's more to come from Kim Jong-un. I'd be surprised if these low-level tests were the only ones we see. There are already reports that they may be kind of restarting some of their nuclear potential test facilities at Yongbyon. So there's more ahead on the North Korea front for sure.
You know, Michael Steele, we've been hearing over the past several months, and we certainly heard from the Trump administration, the need to take a really harsh tone towards China. Mm-hmm. I understand it. And me, and I think most Americans, by most policymakers, we're concerned by what we see with the Uyghurs. We're concerned about what we see in Hong Kong. We're concerned what we see about unfair competition between the currency manipulation. We can go down the list. But when we take that tough line, which maybe that's the only thing we can take, we have to understand we don't have a working partner on North Korea. We don't have a working partner on the environment. We don't have a working partner on human rights. We don't have a working partner on climate change. Again, the Chinese, yes. The Chinese have not been as helpful as they've needed to be. And yes, we are shocked. Our consciences are shocked by much of what we see there. But we share the world stage with China. It is a bipolar world again. And if anything's going to happen, it's going to happen when we figure out how to work together. And if we don't work with them, read the New York Times business section yesterday.
Yeah.
The Germans will. The French will. The Russians will. I mean, a lot of tough choices for the Biden administration to make.
There are a lot of tough choices, and you've got a myriad of examples, Joe, where the Chinese have repositioned themselves globally to be taken seriously by not just those who align themselves with China, but with a lot of our allies as well, as you just referenced. When you look at how the Chinese have repositioned themselves on the African continent, if you look at how they've repositioned themselves in Europe, it presents a very interesting and, I think, dynamic challenge for the U.S., as opposed to the posture of the previous administration, which was one that was purely set against the Chinese as anti-China. That's our enemy. The Biden administration has been trying to figure out the solution or the ways in which they can reset that global table so that they can pull their chair, the U.S. chair, back up to that table and reengage with the Chinese, given the dynamic relationships that they have developed globally that positions them to be, if you will, a thought leader on some of these big policy decisions, which has not been their position in the past. People need to understand, and I'm sure a lot of folks in the intelligence community can tell you, the Chinese play the long game. They do not play the short order game that the U.S. and other nations tend to play, looking at what's right in front of them. The Chinese have for some time now been positioning themselves for just moments like this, and they know the card they're going to play. We've got to figure out what we have in our hand first before we play out.
David, you say the relationship between President Trump and Kim Jong-un was highly unusual. I was part of that president's DMZ trip, so I'd say that's an understatement. Two related questions for you. One is, I know North Korea is such a black hole. Is there any sense there of what the toll the pandemic has ravaged upon that country? Is there any sort of vaccines that North Korea has their hands on? And who's stepping into that goal, with into that void with aid? Is that perhaps China? And that's my other question, is the U.S. relationship with China, the Biden administration with China. You know, you said the meeting this week was gotten off to a rocky start. You've just written about the subject. Where do you think the Biden administration needs to go in terms of dealing with Beijing?
Well, first, Jonathan, North Korea is so murky, it's very difficult to get a sense of how severe the pandemic's toll has been. But every report that I've seen suggests that it's been significant. China has been distributing its vaccine, the Sinopharm vaccine, to many of its friends and allies. Is that the case in North Korea? I just can't say. We don't have enough transparency. In terms of where our diplomacy with China should go, I think that the point that the administration wanted to make in the Anchorage meetings was, first, they want to be clearer than Trump was about the range of our differences with China, to be straightforward, to make those part of the dialogue. But they want to have areas of cooperation, Afghanistan, now North Korea, Iran, climate change, as areas where the two countries' interests converge and they will seek to work together. I think one striking fact about the round of meetings in Anchorage was that it was preceded very deliberately by visits from Secretary of State Blinken and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin to our key allies in the region, to Japan and South Korea. The Chinese didn't like that. They didn't like having our two top officials in their backyard, reminding them of an important fact about Asia, which is that the United States has reliable partners and China doesn't. China is not popular with its neighbors. So looking forward, I'd say that's really the strongest card the U.S. has to play. Yeah, we have in Japan, in South Korea, increasingly in India, key nations, strong economies that surround China, that share U.S. views that the Chinese are being too aggressive and assertive. So on the basis of those relationships, I think the administration hopes to build its China policy going forward.
Okay, we've got a lot to talk to you, David, about around the world, but let's move to this now. The European Union in the final stages of passing legislation that will drastically cut exports for the next 6 weeks of coronavirus vaccines produced in its territory. The move comes as supply shortages have plagued the EU amid a third wave of the virus. One of the countries that will likely feel the biggest brunt of the temporary ban is the United Kingdom. Yesterday, Prime Minister Boris Johnson touted his own country's successful vaccine rollout. According to The Guardian, Johnson told MPs on a private call, quote, "The reason we have the vaccine success is because of capitalism, because of greed, my friends." The prime minister reportedly attempted to walk back the comments during the call.
Good God.
And spoke about not engaging in a tit-for-tat export ban in response to the EU's move.
And we'll continue to work with European partners to deliver the vaccine rollout. What I can say is that we in this country don't believe in blockades of any kind of vaccines or vaccine material. Not something that this country would dream of engaging in.
Well. Gordon Gekko, if Gordon Gekko had a British accent, rode a bike,
and didn't comb his hair. Let's bring in right now former Treasury official and Morning Joe economic analyst Steve Rattner, also U.S. national editor at the Financial Times, Ed Luce, and Washington anchor for BBC World News America, Caddy K. Ed Luce, you can talk about Boris Johnson if you'd like and those bizarre statements yesterday. But I'm curious what your thoughts are about the EU so mishandling, so botching the rollout, the vaccine rollout, that now they're trying to make the British pay.
Yeah, let me take up your invitation, first of all, to talk about Boris Johnson. But I promise not to go on for too long. The irony of his comments about greed and capitalism is that AstraZeneca is one of the only companies, if not the only vaccine maker, to have pledged to do it non-profit. And of course, it was developed at Oxford University with public funding. So I think his comments were misdirected if he was talking about greed having motivated them. The European problem is huge and growing. We're now into a third wave. There are lockdowns being reimposed across the continent. The much cherished, for very good reasons, European summer, again looking to be in jeopardy at a time when, you know, most Europeans were led to expect we'll have reached herd immunity by then. And now they're discovering that the procurement deals that Brussels painstakingly, but taking a very long time to have struck, leading to vaccination rates that are about a quarter of the level in Britain. Only about 10% of Europeans have been vaccinated. About a third the level that we're seeing in the United States. And it looks likely to remain that way for some time to come. And then now we've got the sort of added complication of AstraZeneca's supply problems. And Europe complaining that it isn't delivering enough vaccines, but at the same time, Europe putting temporary bans on AstraZeneca over fears of blood clots. So there's a lot of confusion, and fueling all this is growing public frustration across Europe at the prospect of another ruined summer.
And Caddy, Brexiteers, I have to be celebrating their position right now, because the EU could not look any more hapless right now in the midst of this terrible public crisis than they are. And to add insult to injury, last night we heard the breaking news that, of course, the EU was going to try to stop pharmaceutical companies from exporting vaccines to Britain.
Yeah, I mean, this does play into a notion that Britain is better off alone, and Brexiteers are certainly seizing on that. In fact, technically, Britain could have had its own vaccine supply negotiations anyway, whether or not it was in the European Union. But it does look good for Britain and not good for the European Union. At the moment, all of the focus of attention is on one plant, one vaccine factory in the Netherlands, which is sitting on a stockpile of vaccines that both the European Union and the UK think they have the rights to. Now, the UK's had an excellent vaccine rollout program, even better than the United States. But it's facing a shortfall for the next 3 months. And remember, it made this kind of decision to just give people, lots of people, the first dose. Now it's looking at a three-month period where it could have a shortfall of vaccines. And it really wants those vaccines that are sitting in that AstraZeneca plant in the Netherlands. And those are the vaccines that the EU is saying, hold on a second, we thought we were going to get more vaccines early on from some of those AstraZeneca plants that are in the UK, and you didn't give them to us. So now we're going to look at those vaccines in the Netherlands, and it's turning into this kind of incredible squabble. And as one epidemiologist described it to me last week, you know, a vaccine is like making a cake. You need bits from all over the place. And if you start cutting, you know, stopping borders and having bans on bits moving backwards and forwards, the whole system starts unraveling pretty quickly.
Yeah. And Steve, you have charts looking at how Europe has fared during the pandemic. But before we get to that, can you just speak generally to the bureaucratic snafus, the bureaucratic bungling that has led to the EU to this position?
Sure. And my charts are designed to illustrate some of that. But the EU has been a very difficult organization to operate, really, for the entirety of its existence. You have 27 member countries who all have their own points of view. And if you move it to the vaccine, they have 27 different health departments that all have to be reconciled in terms of product liability, to give you an example, which is of concern to the drug companies. And so all of this took time, and that is part of why the EU was so far behind the curve in terms of its just ability to make decisions quickly. It didn't want to pay as much as the U.S. was willing to pay, and Britain was willing to pay for their vaccines. So they went to AstraZeneca, which is the lowest cost vaccine, and tried to negotiate lower deals. And because it was slow and because they were trying to take lower deals, it simply put them toward the back of the line. And so it's not entirely surprising in the context of how the EU operates to see what kind of decision making they make. And so just to put some flesh on the bones of what Ed and Katty went through so well, you can see here how far behind the EU is in vaccinating. The top blue line is the United Kingdom, which, as Ed said, has done even better than the United States, with 45% of its population having at least one dose and 45% having a vaccines put into arms, excuse me, and 42% having at least one dose. The United States has put vaccines into arms at least 38 per 100 people, 25% fully vaccinated. And then you see at the bottom, France, Germany, and Italy, as representative of the largest countries in the EU, sitting at less than 10% for all the reasons we talked about it. They were also very risk averse. They wouldn't take a risk on the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, which are based on a messenger RNA technology. They wanted a more conventional technology. They wanted lower prices. They moved slowly, and this is what they got. But to your point, Joe, you have to put this in a broader context of how the EU functions. And I'm showing you here, in effect, the bottom line, as we say, of the economic performance of the EU versus the US and the UK over the 20 years since the introduction of the euro being a particular problem for the countries that went into it. Britain never, of course, did go into it. But what you can see is that over those 20 years, the U.S. grew its GDP at an average annual rate of 2.17%. May not sound like a huge amount, but it compounds over 20 years. And you can see the EU at 1.62%. You can see the U.K. in between at 1.87%. And then again, the three largest economies, much slower. And of course, poor Italy down at the bottom. And another way to look at this is in terms of unemployment. And so if you look at the unemployment record over that same 20-year period since the introduction of the euro, you can see the EU at 6.5%. You can see the U.S. down at 3.6%, next to the U.K. at 3.8%. And so, again, substantially lower unemployment in the U.K. and the U.S. And even as we said, these are figures from just before the pandemic hit to make them look even. But even today, as we sit here, most of the European countries still have unemployment higher than ours. So whether I would or wouldn't have voted for Brexit, I think about a lot. But it is very hard looking at all this and looking backwards, not to say that Britain had a point in leaving the EU, and certainly had a major point in not entering the common currency when it was put in place in 1999. They seem to be very clearly, at least economically, far better off for that. Joe?
Steve Bratner, thank you so much, and thank you for the chart that shows the United States towering over all other countries with their GDP at 2.17. We are like the tallest building in Schenectady. Thank you so much, Steve Bratner. Ed Luce, I'm curious your thoughts on Steve's charts and Steve's conclusion that the EU has been anything but this sterling example of bureaucratic efficiency.
Yeah, I think Steve's charts illustrate a point very well. I mean, what I'd say about Britain's outperformance of the European Union is that that's, I think, to do with, as Steve said, Britain not having joined the euro. What Britain did on January the 31st this year was leave the European single market, which is enormously beneficial to Britain, which Britain helped shape. In fact, Margaret Thatcher partly sort of gave birth to it, if you like, in the 1980s. And almost half of Britain's exports, including presumably some vaccines at some point, go to the European Union. So this Brexit, I think, was a deep blow against Britain. But this is undoubtedly a crisis of legitimacy for Brussels. It's a crisis of reputation across Europe, and it's going to be a real, no pun intended, shot in the arm to Eurosceptics in other countries across Europe to watch just how badly they bungled these very basic procurement negotiations and continue to do so. It's very bad news for Europe's reputation.
And Katty Kay, let's follow up with the summer. It's interesting what Ed had said before about many in Britain going to be disappointed across Europe. They're not going to be able to get away on a summer vacation. I'm curious, are we going to find ourselves in a very strange position of having the United States, if not almost fully vaccinated, moving towards herd immunity and being able to travel to Europe, while Europeans from certain countries may not be able to travel here?
Yeah, I mean, the moment Europeans can't travel to the U.S. unless you're a resident or have a family member living here or have a compelling reason to come here, you're just not allowed to get into the United States. And one thing we've learned during the course of this virus, I think, is pretty humbling, right? I mean, every time we think we're ahead, another country might get ahead and then we fall behind and then we get a spike. Well, Europe's right in that position. It was looking so much better and now they're in a big spike. But the vaccine is the game changer. We are so far ahead in the United States in terms of vaccinating that we may be able to now withstand any future spikes because we're getting so many people having immunity through the vaccine. And that's Europe's problem. They haven't got the immunity from the vaccine, so they're just open. I mean, it's open season for more surges and spikes of the coronavirus. And so long as that is happening, everybody's going to be nervous about going there. And the one thing they're really concerned about is how widespread the South African vaccine variant is in Europe. And that's the variant that, of course, withstands, to some extent, we think, the vaccines that we have. So Brits probably aren't going to be going to Europe. It's a big tradition for Brits to go on holiday in Europe. I would love to be going to Europe to see friends and family. It probably isn't going to happen. Americans, I suspect, what might be allowed to go because Europeans will want them to go because they'll want those tourist dollars. But I think Americans are going to have to think carefully about going to a continent where there is this South African variant and potentially bringing it back to the U.S. just when we've got into such a good position here. So I think international travel, the message of this is until we vaccinate everybody, we don't have travel in the way that we're used to it. Sorry.
All right.
No summer holiday in South France, guys.
Wow. Well, no, but I will tell you the good news, of course, for me is I'll be able to summer in the south of Alabama, L.A., lower Alabama.
Nothing wrong with that.
Katty Kay, BBC's Katty Kay and Financial Times' Ed Luce. We know you both have very busy days ahead of you. We really appreciate you starting it with us this morning. Thank you so much. David, I want to get back to you and I've been wanting to talk to you about a couple of issues right now that we talked long and hard about during the Trump administration, and I certainly expressed some concerns about it. I'm just curious, we just passed the 10-year anniversary, the horrific 10-year anniversary of the start of the Syrian civil war. We have talked in the past about how the United States, how Donald Trump made the decision to abandon the Kurds. Is there any chance that the United States may be able to move back into a position where we are protecting the Kurds, where we are pushing back on Iranian militia, where we're pushing back on some of the other nightmarish scenarios that were unfolding in Syria?
Joe, I hear no talk at the Pentagon among my contacts of increasing the U.S. mission in northeast Syria. We're continuing it. We still have something under 1,000 U.S. Special Operations Forces in eastern Syria working with the Syrian Kurdish, so-called Syrian Democratic Forces. I think the idea is to help them stabilize that region of Syria in anticipation that at some point there will be international negotiations to rebuild a Syrian state, Geneva negotiations with a substantial Russian input. If anything, I think the trend is toward reduction, continued reduction of U.S. forces, both in Iraq and Syria. My sense, Joe, is for the Biden administration, in most of these foreign issues, we talked earlier about North Korea, but also Syria and Iraq, it's steady as she goes. Their focus is on domestic policy. They think that the United States' biggest national security issue is our weakness at home. Solve the pandemic, get the economy roaring again, which it's on its way to roaring. We were looking at Steve's charts a moment ago, 2.17%. We're heading towards 6.5% growth this year. I mean, crazy number that we haven't seen in many years. So an American economy that's growing at that rate, that's solving its pandemic problems, suddenly looks like a different figure on the world stage. That's the Biden administration's hope. And they think from that will come new leverage to deal with all these problems, like the dealing with China. The best thing we can do to have a strong China policy is to have a stronger U.S. I've heard that from a number of administration officials. But in terms of, yeah, of restarting the Syria mission, as you and I were talking about, I don't think so.
And Afghanistan yesterday, the Times reported that ISIS was moving and expanding in Afghanistan, waiting for a void, waiting for the United States to leave. Many believe waiting for that time to expand operations there. Do you believe the Biden administration is going to, as you said, continue a steady as it goes policy? Or do you think their ultimate goal is removing all of those troops from Afghanistan and creating that void that ISIS took advantage of when we did the same thing in Iraq a decade ago?
Joe, I think Joe Biden in his gut, in his heart, wants to get those troops out. He has been a skeptic about Afghanistan from the beginning, but I think he's come to realize in the last several weeks that it simply isn't possible to meet the withdrawal deadline of May 1. There's no way you can get the troops and equipment out of Kabul, out of Afghanistan in time. So those troops are going to stay a while longer. The question is whether you can negotiate a framework for stabilization of the country that would allow an orderly withdrawal. If you think about what the images of a quick withdrawal under fire would look like, it would be like Saigon in 1975, but in some ways worse. You'd have black flags flying, Taliban celebrating, guns shooting in the air, and a sense of a country coming apart. The Biden administration very much doesn't want that. They've got aggressive, creative diplomacy. I credit Secretary of State Blinken. He's trying to draw the Russians in, the Chinese, the Pakistanis, even the Iranians into some plan for an orderly withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan. Good on him. But so far, we have not seen much progress. Peace in Afghanistan is the kind of thing everybody supports in principle, but nobody wants to give up their small bit of leverage. And that's been the problem for 20 years. It still is.
David Ignatius from The Washington Post, thank you very much for being on this morning and for your insight this morning.